Good morning. Welcome to the Monadnock Summer Lyceum. My name is Peter Gosline, and I am the moderator for this morning's program. Since 1828, the Monadnock Summer Lyceum has been bringing outstanding world-class speakers to the Monadnock region to serve as a catalyst to inform, engage, and inspire an active citizenry on local, national, and global issues. The Monadnock Summer Lyceum is held at the historic Unitarian Universalist Church in downtown Peterborough, New Hampshire, at 11 o'clock on summer Sunday mornings. We invite our New Hampshire Public Radio audience to attend these programs and to meet our speakers at the reception following the program. After the talk, I will read questions from our live audience. Our speaker today is Christy Hager. I did some homework to refresh my memory about the organization of our executive branch. There are 15 departments that make up the President's Cabinet. One of these is the Department of Health and Human Services, or DHHS. The current Secretary of DHHS is Kathleen Sebelius, former Governor of Kansas. DHHS is the department of the federal executive branch most involved with our nation's human concerns. Its jurisdiction includes, in addition to other services, regulation and control of funding for healthcare, public health, and medical research. Its responsibilities include major programs such as the FDA, NIH, CDC, and Medicare and Medicaid. DHHS hosts 10 regional offices that directly serve state and local organizations. Region 1 of the regional offices includes all 6 New England states, including New Hampshire. In 2010, Christy Hager was appointed by President Obama as regional director of DHHS Region 1. In this position, she leads Secretary Sebelius's efforts to improve the health and enhance the delivery of human services to some of the most vulnerable populations throughout New England. Prior to her current appointment, she was chief health counsel to the Speaker of the Massachusetts House of Representatives during the development, drafting, and first 3 years of implementation of the Massachusetts Health Reform Law, first enacted in 2006. She also previously worked on the editorial staff of the New England Journal of Health. She is currently on the faculty at the Harvard School of Public Health and has taught in graduate programs across New England. She holds an AB from Smith College, an MPH from the Boston University School of Public Health, and a JD from the University of Connecticut School of Law. Pretty darn impressive for just a kid from Fitchburg, as she calls herself. Please join me in welcoming Christy Hager.
Good morning, and thank you, Peter, for that very kind introduction. And you will hear a lot from me this morning about the work that I've been doing on behalf of Secretary Sebelius and the Department of Health and Human Services, but it is true that when I am here in the Monadnock region, I am just a kid from Fitchburg, and I come to you with my childhood memories of ice cream and pony rides at Silver Ranch, and watching the planes take off and land at the airport. Not so much of climbing that mountain, but the ice cream, certainly, is my memory. Thank you for the introduction, Peter. Thank you, George, for the music as we all entered this beautiful church. And as I, my second home has been Boston for close to 25 years, just around the corner from the Old North Church. It's wonderful to feel at home in this other another Bullfinch church here, this beautiful building. It was an incredible honor to be appointed by President Obama just days after he signed the Affordable Care Act to work on a historic agenda in what is assuredly a new era of health reform. The history of health reform and of innovative thinking and doing is long and strong here in New England, which is significant for a couple of reasons. It means that states here are particularly well-positioned to embrace health reform. and that our region states already are serving as illustrations of so many of federal health reform's benefits and opportunities. As I often say, I may not be old enough for Medicare, but I am almost the same age as Medicare, created in 1965 for the elderly and disabled, 65 years and older, along with Medicaid that same year for the poorest of our citizens. And in that same year, the community health centers were established by legislation sponsored by Senator Edward Kennedy during his first full term in the Senate to provide basic medical care and social supports in neighborhoods. Since then, there have been efforts to make incremental changes to expand access to health insurance coverage. The Children's Health Insurance Program and Medicare's first prescription drug benefit, to name a couple, over just the past couple of decades. Then, on March 23, 2010, President Obama signed historic legislation passed by Congress and made health reform history with the promise to expand access to affordable health insurance coverage to tens of millions of uninsured Americans and to transform the healthcare delivery system to bring quality health services and consumer protections to all Americans, with unprecedented investments in public health and community health and in the nation's primary care workforce. This is real life-changing policy, and it's focused squarely on you, your family, your friends, and your workers in your state, cities and towns, and in your neighborhoods. For the past 20 or more years, states have struggled to expand access and maintain consumer protections and insurance on their own. New England states have seen up closer than most some of the successes and challenges faced while working to enact some of the most aggressive and most ambitious state reforms in the country, all without nearly the tools that the Affordable Care Act now offers to states: grant funding, technical assistance, and close partnership among them. A couple of weeks ago, the U.S. Supreme Court upheld the constitutionality of the Affordable Care Act, and this historic decision means that hardworking middle-class families will get the security they deserve. And for us at the department, it means that we have not had to shift one bit from the course of full-force implementation that we have been on all along. We've been living that history for the past 2+ years already. New England has some of the most powerful examples of innovative thinking and doing with respect to public health and healthcare, and there's more to come. So there's lots to share with you this morning, and I also want to give you first a bit of an orientation to the regional infrastructure of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, which is right here to serve New England. Then fill you in on some key features of the Affordable Care Act, or the federal health reform law, and what it does and has already done for different populations in this country. And I hope, of course, to urge you to consider what health reform means for you and your own families. I was appointed to serve as Secretary Kathleen Sebelius' senior representative to Region 1 of HHS, one of 10 regions of the department in the country. And as Peter said, it is comprised of the 6 New England states, and it's headquartered in Boston. About 13 or so of the divisions of the Department of Health and Human Services have a staff presence in the regional office headquarters in Boston, including the largest of the divisions, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, or CMS, the Administration for Children and Families, which works with the Head Start, Child Support Enforcement, and Child Welfare Authorities in the states, the Office for Civil Rights, the Office of the Inspector General, Office of the Assistant Secretary for Preparedness, and the Office of the Assistant Secretary of Health, where the traditional public health functions lie, and the FDA, and you'll hear of others as I go. My responsibilities include serving as the Secretary's liaison to the 6 governors, state health and human services officials, insurance commissioners, federally recognized tribes, and to our non-governmental stakeholder partners as well: hospitals, community health centers, physicians, and other health professionals, parents, children, seniors, small businesses, health insurers, and the faith community. And let me assure you, as a former governor and state insurance commissioner herself, Secretary Sebelius is quite clear with us, her 10 regional directors throughout the country, to get out there and be out there, to work closely with our partners in the states, and to facilitate collaboration across the divisions of the department to support our partners in the states as effectively as possible. And the Secretary's priority of cross-division collaboration at the department is shared at the highest level by President Obama and throughout his cabinet. We are directed to reach out to our federal agency partners as well. My HUD counterpart and I are likely to come to a smoke-free public housing development near you, for example, perhaps with an EPA colleague as well. And the regional administrator of the U.S. Small Business Administration and I have worked closely on outreach and education with small businesses throughout New England. The USDA, Department of Education, and Department of Transportation last year joined me in the Let's Move City of Keene last year to celebrate the one-year anniversary of First Lady Michelle Obama's initiative to promote children's nutrition and physical activity. And my responsibilities also include leading the regional office's outreach and education activities with respect to health reform. And that, along with Secretary Sebelius's clear direction to get out there, is why my travels over the past 26 months have covered more than 25,000 miles of driving and two windshields throughout New England, from southern Connecticut up to the Indian reservations of Maine along the Canadian border, to some of the region's most rural and remote community-based health providers just down the road from the border crossing to Campobello Island. And here in New Hampshire, I've been welcomed in my role by Peter Goslin and Audrey White at the Monadnock Community Hospital just up the road to hear about the community health services there at Dartmouth-Hitchcock Keene just over the mountain, through the urban center of Manchester, and I'm hoping soon to visit Colebrook up on your Canadian border, where the Indian Stream Valley Community Health Center recently was awarded a capital improvement grant to support its work on providing primary and preventive care in one of the most remote parts of the state. It's all been in the interest of a closer relationship between the departments and states and communities to meet people where they live and work. And throughout the diversity of New England, we have urban and rural experiences, large immigrant populations, some of the worst poverty in the country, middle-class communities, and the state with the highest median age in the country. Now, you must know, if you don't already, how federal health reform, the Affordable Care Act, affects you, your parents, children, friends, and your business. I'll share with you today some compelling and awesome statistics and numbers about how many individuals and businesses have benefited from various provisions of the law, how many grant dollars have come to New Hampshire and to New England to support the goals of health reform. But I will tell you that there are no statistics more compelling and no numbers more stunning than the stories of people with names, with personal stories, whose lives already have changed immeasurably and in real ways because of health reform. In March, I participated in a panel in Manchester, moderated by Peter Brough's own Heidi Copeland, publisher of Business New Hampshire magazine, marking the two-year anniversary of the passage of health reform at Manchester Community College. The stories we heard that day resonate every day as we at the department track the significant progress of health reform. The goals and themes of health reform are several: offering new consumer protections and consumer choice in health insurance, making healthcare more affordable, not just by reducing overall system costs, but by reducing the out-of-pocket expense for low and middle-income Americans included, an unprecedented investment in public health and the principles of prevention, strengthening Medicare for our seniors and disabled, improving the quality of care and investing in innovation in the delivery of care, and expanding health insurance coverage. Each of these goals is served by a number of provisions of the Affordable Care Act. Do we have time for all 900 pages or so of the Act this morning? No? Okay. But for years, discussion of the long elusive goal of expanding access has always begged the question, access to what? And I'll tell you what. Some highlights. Under the old system, no one got a worse deal than the 129 million Americans with pre-existing conditions. When they bought coverage on their own, insurance companies could hike their rates or carve out needed benefits or lock them out of the insurance market altogether. Protection from being denied insurance coverage due to a pre-existing condition is already available to the 540,000 children in the country who had an illness like asthma or diabetes and were uninsured. All adults will enjoy the same protections by 2014. In the meantime, a pre-existing condition insurance plan offers coverage for adults in every state, including nearly 450 people in New Hampshire, like Gail O. of Keene, who has been able to continue treatments for her non-Hodgkin's lymphoma after the loss of her health insurance. Lifetime limits are being eliminated in new health plans, and annual limits are being phased out until 2014, when they will be eliminated completely. On a recent trip to Maine, I met Teresa B., whose husband, Rocky, had been diagnosed with cancer and then almost immediately hit the lifetime limit of his insurance policy, quickly over $1 million in personal debt. Rocky died within a few months on the day before President Obama signed the Affordable Care Act. Now, over 500,000 people in New Hampshire have protection from lifetime limits that wasn't available to Rocky. We know that over the last decade, insurance premiums nationally have been growing 3 times faster than wages. Now there's no more fear of double-digit premium increases from your insurance company without accountability. The New Hampshire Insurance Department has received more than $4 million from HHS to review proposed rate increases of 10% or more that are deemed unreasonable, and to require transparency and to disapprove those proposed increases if they're not justified. And insurers must now spend no less than 80 cents on every premium dollar on patient care rather than on administrative costs like salaries and marketing. If they fail to meet that 80% minimum, then they must refund the money to their enrollees. HHS announced just a few weeks ago that nationwide this year, insurers are projected to return over $1 billion in rebates for not meeting this standard for nearly 13 million consumers. It also will no longer be legal for insurance companies to drop you from coverage, especially when you're sick and need it most, just for an honest mistake on your application. And making healthcare more affordable for parents and accessible to their adult children up to age 26 is a significant benefit of health reform that's been in effect already for 2 years, nearly 2 years. And more than 3 million young adults had gained such coverage by the end of 2011. And we know that even in New England, where roughly half the states already had some version of allowing adult children to be covered under their parents' policy, 77,000 10,000 of them just here in New Hampshire are covered under their parents' policy, now without any restrictions on their marital status or their place of residence. Your child doesn't have to live with you. They don't even have to live in the same state. And small businesses historically have suffered a disadvantage, paying usually 18% more for their employees' coverage than the larger chains with which they compete. The insurance market has been broken for them. And that's a big part of the reason why small employers are a third less likely than large companies to offer health benefits to their workers. Under health reform, small businesses, regardless of tax status, with less than 25 full-time equivalent employees and average wages of less than $50,000, who contribute required amounts, required minimums to their workers' premiums, have been eligible since tax year 2010 to receive a health care tax credit of up to 35% of their healthcare contributions. Since health reform was passed, I've met a range of business owners who've benefited from this tax credit: a nonprofit daycare center in the middle of Boston, a bowling alley in Johnston, Rhode Island, and Nancy C's marketing firm in North Conway. Nancy told us in Manchester in March on that panel, Her story of reusing paper clips and turning off the heat after her workers left every day to be able to maintain her commitment to their health insurance. Nancy's tax credit made all the difference for her to be able to do just that, and her story is now featured right on the homepage of the department's website, healthcare.gov, alongside Gail O. We know that getting the right preventive care, like cancer screenings and vaccines, is one of the best ways to stay healthy. But too many Americans have gone without this care because it often required expensive copays. In many cases, you now can get certain preventive services for free. Regular well baby and well child visits, including routine vaccinations, cancer screenings such as mammograms and colonoscopies, vaccinations such as flu, mumps, and measles, cholesterol screening, tobacco cessation counseling and interventions, and depression screening. Nearly 280,000 privately insured people in New Hampshire have benefited from free preventive services, including 107,000 women and 70,000 children. Nationally, a total of 54 million privately insured individuals have taken advantage of these free services. But investing in public health and prevention means not only requiring that certain preventive services are covered for individuals without any cost sharing, but also making grants to improve community health and support the public health infrastructure. And the state of New Hampshire has received $4.5 million in grants for these purposes. We also have an opportunity with new resources and a specific agenda to do more about health disparities. Patient outcomes and treatments shouldn't differ based on race or ethnicity or gender identity or gender expression. New data collection methods are being developed at the department so that we can better measure and quantify disparities in health and be more able to eliminate them. The burden of chronic disease and illness shouldn't be greater for African Americans than for whites, nor greater for Latinos than for Asian Americans. We're focusing more on how to prevent diabetes and heart disease early to prevent greater illness later in life. The health of lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender persons is the subject of increased efforts within HHS, where there's an internal coordinating council that works across divisions of the department to develop policies that are responsive to the needs of the LGBT community. Recently, I attended the Over the Rainbow Supper Club at the House of Seven Gables in Salem, Massachusetts, where LGBT seniors meet monthly over a nutritious meal and share experiences with healthcare, including behavioral health, human services, housing, and employment. Soon after, I convened a meeting in my office with LGBT and elder services advocates and the regional leadership of HHS's Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration and HHS's Administration for Community Living to discuss how we can better identify and address the needs of LGBT elders in the communities in our region. Empowering our LGBT youth also is a focus of efforts within the department, especially in substance abuse and mental health, and is an important concern of the secretary, who recently joined Lady Gaga at the launch of her Born This Way Foundation at Harvard University to develop supports for empowering youth. A single award was made by HHS's Health Resources and Services Administration for a National LGBT Technical Assistance and Training Center for health professionals. In yet another New England distinction, it was awarded to the Fenway Health Institute in Boston. Health reform has meant huge improvements in Medicare. Some of our most gratifying work has been with audiences of seniors who deserve the reassurance that the Medicare program is stronger than ever for them. For the first time, there are new preventive services available with no out-of-pocket costs, no copay, no deductible, and as I always say to them, no excuses. We know that in the first year that they were available, almost 165,000 Medicare beneficiaries in New Hampshire and 32.5 million nationally received services like screening mammograms and screening colonoscopies and wellness visits with their provider. And we want all of them to know those benefits are available. Last year, I held an educational event for seniors at the Town Hall Lanes in Johnston, Rhode Island. Yes, that sounds like the name of a bowling alley, and it is a bowling alley. I had visited that bowling alley in the spring of 2011, around the time of the first year anniversary of the Affordable Care Act, with the regional administrator of the U.S. Small Business Administration, because its owner had received a nearly $10,000 health care tax credit for his contribution to his employees' health insurance. So we had walked in on a Monday or a Tuesday morning at 10 o'clock or so to talk with the owner about his tax credit, and half the lanes were lit up, and there were all these people bowling, all of them elders. And I asked the owner if I could come back sometime with other colleagues to do a Medicare education event there. He thought I was kidding. But a few months later, I got some of the Boston regional staff from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid, and we partnered with the Rhode Island State Director of Elder Affairs, and we went back during the Senior League time. We had our big banner for the Share the News, Share the Health, Medicare Preventive Services awareness campaign set up right on the lanes. There were about 100 people there. The owner was passing around fruit salads, wearing his bowling shirt. We had a nurse in the corner doing pre- and post-bowling blood pressure checks. The political reporter from the Providence TV station showed up with a cameraman, and he said to me before he started taping, "Why are you in a bowling alley?" And I said, "These people are not sitting in the Johnston Senior Center, so we came to them." More relief for seniors and disabled on Medicare. The gap in prescription drug coverage in Medicare, known as the donut hole, has begun to shrink already and will close completely by 2020. In the meantime, in 2010, the first year of the law, seniors and the disabled who hit that gap in coverage received a one-time $250 rebate check and now a 50% discount in brand name drugs purchased while in the donut hole. About 21,000 beneficiaries of Medicare in New Hampshire have now saved an average of a total of $14 million, close to about $600 each. This makes all the differences for those seniors who need coverage most when they're in the donut hole. The great news of the improvements in Medicare is also an occasion to remind seniors about preventing Medicare fraud and that they must be careful to keep their Medicare number close and private, as they would their Social Security or credit card numbers. Anyone who gets their Medicare number can bill Medicare for services that they never received or that were never rendered. One of the major sources of savings in health reform is the strengthened partnership between HHS and the Department of Justice to prevent and detect fraud in the Medicare and Medicaid programs. In the first year of their work, after the law was passed, $4 billion were recovered. And in the past 3 years combined, over $10 billion in fraudulent payments made by the Medicare and Medicaid programs. And we know that's just a portion of the total fraudulent claims. These efforts use new data analytic tools that are much like the credit card companies have been using for years, you know, where they can call you and say, "Did you really just buy 10 flat screen TVs in Cleveland yesterday?" Electronic claim submission enables them to detect fraudulent claim activity before claims are paid, instead of the old pay and chase method, where claims were paid timely and then they chased after what appeared to be fraudulent without nearly the level of success possible now. And that $10 billion is money we'd much rather have in the Medicare Trust Fund to spend on care for seniors and the disabled than in paying phony claims. Seniors have to feel empowered to assist the department in that work, to review their quarterly statements for accuracy and services received, and to call the hotline if they have suspicions. We know from our colleagues in the Office of the Inspector General that a recent case, for example, that represented one of the largest ever recoveries was because a single beneficiary called the TIPS hotline. Health reform is transforming the healthcare delivery system. Innovation by our health providers is such a long and strong tradition here in New England. We often don't even use that term to describe what's often just the way of doing business here. Now, improving the quality of care and investing in innovation is a key area of work under health reform, and much of it is focused in a new innovation center within CMS. Through the breadth of the Medicare and Medicaid programs, finding ways to focus more on value rather than volume, and quality instead of quantity of services, all for better patient care. New alignments and incentives for providers in such new structures as accountable care organizations that focus on the right care in the right place and at the right time show great promise to improve outcomes for patients. And the right place may mean in the community or even at home sometimes, which is supported by new initiatives as well. By improving the quality of care and patient safety, evidence shows us that preventable hospital readmissions and hospital-acquired infections can be reduced to save thousands of lives and prevent millions of injuries each year. One example of a public-private partnership created for this purpose under health reform is called the Partnership for Patients, which has two major goals. One, to keep patients from getting injured or sicker. By the end of 2013, preventable hospital-acquired conditions would decrease by 40% compared to 2010, meaning approximately 1.8 million fewer injuries to patients, with more than 60,000 lives saved over 3 years. Two, to help patients heal without complication. By the end of 2013, preventable complications during a transition from one care setting to another would be decreased so that all hospital readmissions would be reduced by 20% compared to 2010. Achieving this goal would mean more than 1.6 million patients would recover from illness without suffering a preventable complication requiring hospitalization within 30 days of their discharge. Aside from the fact that our healthcare providers deserve a safe healthcare system in which to give the safest and highest quality of care to their patients, we know that it costs a lot less money and a lot less risk to patients' health to do things the right way instead of the wrong way. More than 8,000 organizations have joined the partnership, which could save Medicare $46 billion over the next 10 years. And the Million Hearts Initiative is an example of collaboration between two divisions of HHS, the Centers for Disease Control and Health Promotion, which focuses on preventing illness and promoting health, and the Innovation Center at CMS. It's also an example of an effective community engagement tool to bring together providers, employers, and individuals around health and wellness. Million Hearts seeks to prevent 1 million heart attacks and strokes over 3 years through two main methods. One is community prevention, so increasing awareness of improving physical activity, reducing sodium intake, and better overall nutrition. And two, clinical prevention, the ABCs of appropriate aspirin therapy, blood pressure control, cholesterol management, and smoking cessation. I encourage you to go to www.millionhearts.hhs.gov, take the pledge to become one of the Million Hearts, as I did. I hosted the first launch of Million Hearts in Indian Country in the United States, here in New England, at the Mohegan Reservation in Connecticut. The chief of the Mohegan tribe and I had the idea almost exactly at the same time. She's a cardiac nurse by training, and when she was appointed chief of the tribe a couple of years ago, she had chosen as her Indian name Chief Many Hearts. So it seemed a natural partnership for us to establish the initiative in Indian Country right on their reservation. Now, health information technologies are at the heart of much of the innovation that's going on right now, and make no mistake, the future of electronic health records is now. I'll tell you from my own experience. My daughter, now 4 years old, came home from her 3-year well child visit, and a few days later was playing doctor with her dolls and stuffed animals. And I watched her from across the room take an armful of her dolls and stuffed animals, bring them over to her little activity table, and then picked up her toy laptop, lifted the screen, and turned it to her animals and said, "So, let's see how you're doing today." Just as her pediatrician had done when they plot her growth chart together, the height and weight, and it appears on the screen. So there's your proof that we're in a new era of healthcare, or at least that's how my kid plays doctor. So we know we can build it, this transformed healthcare delivery system with new options for public and private coverage, a consumer-oriented, quality, affordable healthcare and public health system, but they will not come if they don't know it's out there, or they don't know they're eligible, or how or where to apply. So health insurance exchanges will operate in every state by 2014, a new marketplace that will offer enrollment in new health insurance plans for individuals and small businesses, where 18 million individuals with income of up to $45,000 a year and families with incomes up to $92,000 a year for a family of four in 2012 numbers will be able to get tax credits averaging about $4,000 apiece to help them afford health insurance. And small businesses will be able to continue to access the tax credits that are available to them now. There will be no wrong door for entry into this new marketplace. There will be online, phone enrollment, other options, and for enrollment and screening for eligibility for private or public insurance options. States have great flexibility in how to design and operate their exchanges, including having HHS facilitate one for them or in partnership with them. As of last week, 34 states had received approximately $800 million to fund their progress toward building exchanges. These exchanges also will include pathways to enrollment in Medicaid, insurance for the lowest income and most vulnerable, as the law provides for expanded eligibility. You can see many new sources of coverage provided under health reform in full implementation in partnership with the states. 2014 will bring major change with the availability of insurance policies, with the preventive benefits and consumer protections extending to all Americans in or outside the exchange, including the ones that I mentioned earlier. And for the first time, vision and dental services for children will be required coverage in health insurance plans. With so many new insurance options and new tax credits to support their purchase, the estimated 1% of individuals who will be able to afford coverage but not get it at all will be responsible for that choice. So with tens of millions newly insured Americans and millions more with better insurance, we'll need a strong and secure primary care workforce and infrastructure to meet what we hope and expect to be a considerably greater demand for primary and preventive healthcare services. That is why health reform includes an investment of $11 billion in capital improvement and new bricks and mortar of community health centers to double their patient load in neighborhoods and communities throughout the country. And here in New England, over $200 million has already been invested in the infrastructure of community health centers. And a few weeks ago, when I called Ed George at the Manchester Community Health Center to congratulate him on his new $650,000 grant from our Health Resources and Services Administration, he was quite ready to get to work to expand services there. Workforce development is a major area of investment under health reform. The very providers that patients will need when they access care for which they're newly covered. Dr. Terry Brigio joined us on that March day in Manchester to tell us her story of being supported by the National Health Service Corps program that offers loan forgiveness and scholarships to support health professionals who will work with underserved populations. And she had returned to her hometown of Hillsborough to do just that. In conclusion, let me just say that the bottom line is that no person and no family should be driven to bankruptcy or worse, to die in bankruptcy because of a lack of health insurance and the security that it provides. Parents deserve the peace of mind that their children can graduate from school or enter the workforce with the health coverage they need to help them as well. Seniors and the disabled deserve the reassurance that the Medicare program is stronger than ever for them, and that they are protected from high out-of-pocket costs for care to keep them well. All Americans deserve the protections from unreasonable and unpredictable health insurance rate increases, rescissions of coverage, and to be able to access preventive health and wellness services without expensive cost sharing. This law was specifically designed to give states the resources and the flexibility they need to tailor their approach to their specific needs. Instead of throwing out the current market system, the Affordable Care Act preserves the current system. It takes the existing infrastructures and markets and tries to make them better, taking great efforts to preserve consumer choice and protection. You all know enough about health reform to share information about its benefits with your family, your neighbors, your parents, and your children, so please do. We're more than 2 years into implementation of a historic health insurance coverage law, and there's more to go. I hope you'll visit healthcare.gov for more information and to keep track of what's happening well. And finally, just let me say, it is an honor to be here as a part of the Monadnock Lyceum and with all of you as we're making history. Thank you.
Thank you, Christy Hager, for your informative and insightful talk. This is the Monadnock Summer Lyceum, hosted by the Unitarian Universalist Church in Peterborough, New Hampshire, and broadcast on New Hampshire Public Radio. We have some time for questions from the audience. While the ushers collect the cards, let me begin by asking, Christy, you mentioned that there were health insurance exchanges planned for each state. I know that states have options or have had options in terms of accepting funding to put together those exchanges. New Hampshire did not accept that funding. Will we be able to get health insurance exchanges for New Hampshire?
Yeah. And, you know, the development of these health insurance exchanges in each state is one of the greatest illustrations of flexibility for states that the law provides, and greatest areas of partnership between the federal department and states. So New Hampshire, under legislation that was recently signed by Governor Lynch, that was passed by the legislature here, will provide the ability for New Hampshire to work in partnership with the department. New Hampshire residents will have no less access to health insurance, new opportunities for health insurance coverage under a state exchange than any other state. There are many options and variations for the form of that partnership and facilitation by the Department of a state exchange. So we'll look forward to working with them on that.
How does health care reform help elders have a good death without millions being spent for futile end-of-life care?
You know, there are, I mentioned really very briefly, because there is such a range of provisions that provide strengthening of the Medicare program and improvement in the quality of care developed for Medicare or provided for Medicare beneficiaries, seniors and disabled alike. One of the areas of initiatives is where I mentioned the right care at the right time in the right place, and where sometimes that care means in the community or at home. There will now be the opportunity for the support and payments of services that are provided, if it's appropriate clinically, in settings other than hospitals. There's also, I mentioned the wellness visits that are available at no charge as part of the preventive services, where there's an opportunity to really focus on preventive care and wellness care, which we know by evidence will reduce the incidence, the burden of greater illness and higher risk care and more hospitalization later in life. So I think there's a combination of supports for Medicare patients and for receiving the appropriate care at the appropriate time.
Here's an easy one. As you know, there are some in the New Hampshire legislature who are resistant to implementing the Affordable Care Act. Are you in communication with this group, and how do you envision this being addressed and resolved?
You know, again, you've heard about how much has happened with implementation of the Affordable Care Act just in the first 2 years that it's been effective, and that there is so much more to go, and that there is great flexibility for states deliberately built into the Affordable Care Act so that states can tailor the opportunities and resources available under the Act for the best interests of their residents. So there are opportunities going forward, particularly now in this phase of implementation of the law, where we will be able to work with all of our stakeholder partners in the states, and that will include members of the legislature, governors, as I mentioned, on making sure that we're able to work with them on fully complying and implementing the law of the land.
What is in place to prohibit health insurance companies from continuing to raise premium costs so newly insured middle-income individuals would still be unable to afford coverage?
So the question specifically asks, what's in the law to prevent insurance companies from raising rates to the point that they're unaffordable? So a couple of things in a couple of different areas of the Act actually combine to address this issue. The first is, as I mentioned, the increased capacity now through the requirement of the law and resources that come directly from the department to states in increasing their capacity for reviewing what are deemed unreasonable proposed rate increases. And that's anything from 10%, generally anything 10% or higher. There's a new requirement for a transparent process and for insurance companies to justify when those rates are needed and for that information to be available. The other is the ability for middle-class families and individuals and businesses to be able to better afford the health care insurance premiums that do exist. And that's through, for example, in very large part, the tax credits that will be available through the exchanges for people up to 400% of the poverty line. And I had given you those statistics. The income eligibility levels are roughly $90,000 for a family of four, and about over $44,000 for a single person, which we project will probably permit close to $4,000 a year in tax credits to be able to afford insurance better.
Thank you. The Supreme Court decision makes the Medicaid expansion optional for states. How many do you think will opt out?
We are working closely with those states who may be considering what exactly their options are with respect to the Medicaid expansion. It's really impossible to say. Impossible to say right now how many states will make the decision to go forward with the expansion. What the Supreme Court, the Supreme Court's holding included the fact that if states choose not to accept 100% full funding from the department to expand Medicaid, they won't be penalized in terms of what other support the department provides for other aspects of the Medicaid program. But we do know from past experience, when the Children's Health Insurance Plan was enacted, for example, several years ago, which was similarly that states had the options of developing no plan at all or a standalone plan or a combination with their Medicaid program, that very soon all 50 states participated. So we will work closely with all of the states that have questions and that we want to work as closely as possible with to effectively as possible implement that provision.
What are you doing about alternative treatment, such as homeopathic?
I mentioned so there's a couple of parts of the law that may address that question. I mentioned in the exchanges that for the first time, pediatric vision and dental benefits will be required to be part of insurance coverage. Two categories out of 10 categories of benefits that are going to be required in all health plans by 2014. States, again, another area of flexibility, will be able to decide exactly which services are available in each of those 10 categories of benefits. And so there are states' decisions based on to determine what provisions or what benefits are going to be provided. There's also, as I mentioned, new alignments of provider groups. So through accountable care organizations, through patient-centered medical homes that really take a team approach to caring for patients and to all be invested along with their patients, with more support from the department on what the outcomes are and how much wellness and health are improved in along various measures. So I think that there will be the opportunity for us to work with teams and organizations of providers on just what kinds of care is most appropriate. But nothing specific information on the homeopathic.
Many have said that the health care program passed during the president's first term would serve as a good launching pad for future improvements, such as single payer. Do you see a follow-on during the next administration? That's it. Another easy one.
Let me get my crystal ball for this one. I do have to say that, you know, the Affordable Care Act really quite deliberately was based on the current system and improving the current system and not eliminating it. That is what the law was designed to do. That's what we are following in full implementation, full force implementation of this law every day. And I have to say, based on the progress that I've shared with you this morning, we see that there's been a lot of progress made, significant progress, and really we're on track for even more. So don't know what that will
do. Very briefly, please highlight recent innovations in New England state health services that can be readily replicated in other New England states.
Well, it's a very good question for a number of reasons, one of which is that that is exactly what the Innovation Center was created to do, to identify promising practices and best practices among New England providers, to evaluate them with the department's support and collaboration, and then to replicate them as fast as possible across the country. So I mentioned a couple of times the history of innovation here. So the Innovation Center was created not with the idea that there would be a sealed white envelope in Washington where they would say, I hope providers in the country figure out what we mean by innovation. It's in fact inspired by work that's been already going on in the field. So I'll put in perspective, you know, how strong that tradition of innovation is. So when a type of accountable care organization called the Pioneer Accountable Care Organizations was announced several months ago, there were 32 announced throughout the country. 20% of those were in New England, and 5 were in eastern Massachusetts alone. 1 was up at Dartmouth. So if that gives you some sense of the strength of the potential for innovation here, there is now a catalog of about 30 different initiatives that have come launched from that Innovation Center with a variety of providers across the country. And I'll tell you, that's one handout I didn't bring, but it's available on the web, and I'd be happy to share with you where to find that. But a tremendous amount of investment, not just in funding, not just in technical assistance, but really close collaboration so that we can take those best practices that have been out there and finally, in a very close partnership with the department, replicate them for the benefit of the rest of the country.
Thank you. We have time for one more here, and that's, what's your opinion of the proposals to reform Medicare by replacing programs with money sent to states to distribute to seniors as they see fit, for individuals to buy their insurance and healthcare on their own?
Well, I will respectfully answer by saying I'm not going to render my opinion specifically about those, but I will tell you that what we're doing now in terms of the Medicare program and reforms in it and improvements in it, we think is working pretty well. And that's my answer for that. Sure.
Thank you, Christy Hager, for sharing your time and experience with us today. You have been listening to the Monadnock Summer Lyceum on New Hampshire Public Radio. The Monadnock Summer Lyceum presents a weekly series of lectures held at the Unitarian Universalist Church in Peterborough, New Hampshire. For more information about the Lyceum, you can visit our website at www.monadnocklyceum.org or by writing the Monadnock Lyceum Committee, 25 Main Street, Peterborough, New Hampshire, 03458. The program next Sunday will feature Gordon Perry narrating and introducing a musical program honoring New England musical legend Bob McQuillan, patriarch of the longstanding tradition of New England contra dance music. We will be treated to a concert when this legendary piano player teams up with Jane Orzechowski on fiddle and Deanna Stiles on flute, as well as others. Thank you, Christy Hager, for this interesting examination of the new era of health reform, the New England experience. There have been a number of questions, and I know that Christy would be very willing to respond to additional questions at the reception afterwards. Now, please join us for more time with our presenter and for some refreshments in the parish hall, generously provided by Monadnock Community Hospital and served by the Lyceum Committee, as well as the Monadnock employees. Thank you very much.
People come and people go. They take and they give. Build you up just to let you down. That's just the way that it is. All I need is one friend to get me through the day. One friend that never goes away. Opening one friend. Understand and never lets me down. I've been in love and I've been in pain. I'm a sinner and a saint. All I know is where I go and what I do. It's you I appreciate. All I need is one friend to get me through the day. One friend that never goes away. Oh, dear, one friend to understand and never lets me down. One friend to understand and never let me down. That song's one friend. That one friend is you. Your best friend. He'll never let you down. Taking it easy. Moving slow, it's always quiet just before the storm, you know. Taking my time, singing here. A lovely lady with long and golden hair. Girl, then she came. She gave me reasons, and since we've been together, there's been a change in the weather. She's a rainmaker. Sure put the teardrop in my life. She's a rainmaker. Sure put the teardrop in my life. The day that you came, I threw up my hand. I was really.